Four candidates are running to be the next mayor of Jacksonville. Just ahead, we'll talk to one of them, former Florida Republican Party chairman and Jacksonville businessman Lenny Curry. Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. Now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we'll take your calls for mayoral candidate Lenny Curry. The phones are already lighting up, and that number is 549-2937 to join the conversation. Later, we'll talk about a new historical marker at the site of the southernmost Revolutionary War battle right here in Northeast Florida. We'll also find out how NASA served as a launching pad for a more integrated America. Plus, we'll talk about the nonprofit Blessings in a Backpack, which is working to feed school children on the weekends. All of that ahead. But first this morning, Jacksonville's city election is in 1 week. Lenny Curry wants to be the next mayor, and he's joined us now by phone. Lenny Curry, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning, Jessica. It's good to be with you.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. And to our listeners, what are your questions for Mr. Curry? That number is 549-2937, or go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect to email us, or tweet me at Jessica Pub Radio. That's Jessica, P-U-B, Radio. Now let's get to some questions. Mr. Curry, a recent UNF poll shows voters' number one issue is crime. What would you do as mayor to fight violent crime in Jacksonville?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Well, let me say that the first and most important function of government, and I've been saying this since this campaign started and it's how I'll govern, is the safety of its citizens. That is critical. We must make sure my vision and my plan will make sure that every person and every family and every neighborhood is safe. But it starts with making sure that we have the right number of policemen and women on the street. 147 of those, to be exact, have been cut over the last 4 years as a result of Mayor Alvin Brown's budget. So the first thing that I'll do is restore those policemen and women and put them back on the street. But we have to have a number of all three legs of the stool. We have to have prevention, intervention, and enforcement. You know, the Jacksonville Journey is a program that was started under the John Payton administration, and it was in response to the violent crime and the murder rate we were experiencing back then. And the Jacksonville Journey worked. It brought community leaders together, nonprofit leaders, business leaders, and it invested in programs, organized and coordinated programs, after-school programs for kids, things that give kids some hope and opportunity so we're not having to police our way out of the problem 10, 15 years down the road.
Okay, thank you. Now a question from Facebook. Steve asks, how do you plan to fund the pension, deepen the port, and restore the 147 police jobs without raising taxes, something you promised not to do during the debate?
Yeah, thank you. We have a $1 billion budget. So I'd ask your listeners to let that sink in for a minute. The city has a $1 billion budget. My first budget priority will be the safety of our citizens. So the money's there to restore the police officers. The money's there to invest in programs that will help children generations ahead. The other thing that I will tell you is in this $1 billion budget over the last couple of weeks, specifically Councilman Lori Boyer, has discovered that there's tens of millions of dollars in money that the city has that the city didn't know they had. The mayor's office just didn't know they had. So the very first thing that I'm going to do is get our financial house in order. I'm going to do an emergency 90-day audit. It's going to drill down and see exactly where the city is financially. I'll be able to share that, be transparent with the people of Jacksonville, and have a candid conversation about exactly where this city sits right now. As far as the port goes, look, I have experience as a business person, have directly worked with the Florida legislature and with Governor Rick Scott, when I was the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. And I can tell you that Rick Scott is willing to invest in Florida's assets when cities come together and share with him a plan that shows a return on investment and accountability. So I'll work with the leadership at the port to make sure that we've demonstrated that to the governor and the Florida legislature, And I would expect that under my leadership and with my advocacy, they'll be a big ally in making sure that we get the funding that we need.
Okay, we're going to the phones now. We have lots of calls lined up. Patrick is on the line in Jacksonville. Patrick, you're on with Lenny Curry. What is your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just calling to ask a question to Mr. Curry about his education plan. I know you talked a lot about providing our kids a great education. I was just wondering what the specific details of that plan was.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. Yes, that's a great question. Well, look, I will work diligently with the school board, with the superintendent, to make sure that our kids are getting access to a world-class education. I will be the collaborator. I will help raise money for programs. I will be the chief cheerleader for what happens in the school in the school day every day. But where I can really have the biggest impact is what happens before school and what happens after school. Let's talk a little bit about after school. If you right now are a teacher and you choose to coach high school sports, you get a stipend. And I think that's a good thing, by the way. I'm an advocate for that. I play high school sports, and I think it's good for our kids. However, if you choose to volunteer as a teacher to be a part of an academic program, so say you've decided you want to be a part of an academic program that's related to STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, you don't get a stipend. I will be advocate and fight for teachers to get stipends, those teachers that engage in after-school activities like academic clubs. This could transform our workforce in the years ahead. It will incent teachers to want to be more involved and engaged in academic clubs, and I'll be a big advocate of that. What happens before school? Voluntary pre-K, for example. Right now, the voluntary pre-K programs will be tested. The testing starts next year. So what I'll do is, as mayor, is those programs that test is excellent. Look, in my own business, when you highlight, when you shine a light on those that are performing at the top level, that pushes everyone else towards excellence. And so I'll do that. And here's what will happen. Look, it's voluntary pre-K. When parents see that certain voluntary pre-K programs are performing higher than others, what are they going to do? They're going to move their kids to high-performing schools. So it'll create competition, and it will push every voluntary pre-K program towards excellence.
Mr. Curry, going back to that UNF poll, it showed 62% of likely voters support adding protections to the city's human rights ordinance for gay and transgender people. If, as mayor, would you support that change?
Look, here's what I can tell you about Jacksonville. I have a long history and experience in this city. I remember as a child when the River City Renaissance was new and the South Bank was bustling and the Landing was new. I started practicing accounting here in the mid-90s with the largest accounting firm in the world, interacted with clients and people from all over the city. I've been a business owner in Jacksonville now here for over a decade. My business is headquartered downtown. And over the course of this campaign, I've traveled to all over the city, to every corner of the city. And the people of Jacksonville, they don't discriminate. They are good people. They are loving people. They are caring people. That said, if and where discrimination exists, I will work with those folks that are being discriminated against, and I'll work with other stakeholders and lead a public conversation and make sure that we come up with a Jacksonville solution to any Jacksonville problem.
And does that include amending the human rights ordinance?
I just stated I don't believe that the people of Jacksonville discriminate.
So it's not needed then? A change isn't needed?
I don't believe that the people of Jackson will discriminate. When I'm elected mayor, if and where discrimination exists, I will work with those folks that are being discriminated against, and we will come up with a solution. Discrimination will not be accepted or allowed under my leadership as mayor, but I reject the premise that the people of Jacksonville are discriminatory people.
All right, moving on to the phone. Sarah in Jacksonville has a question for Lenny Curry. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Curry. You may have seen that over this past weekend, there were 6 separate shootings that left 1 person dead and 5 injured. What do you plan on doing to make sure that these kinds of things don't continue?
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you. Well, my top budget priority is making sure that we restore the policemen and women that were cut under Mayor Alvin Brown's budget. And what that will do is allow us to immediately enforce the existing crime and existing problems. But look, when we have the right number of officers on the street, it also gives them time to be able to get out of their cars and spend time building relationships in the community, getting to know people. Right now, those men and women just don't have the time because there aren't enough of them. They're being stretched thin. They're running from call to call. There's really stress in terms of their ability to respond quickly. So putting the right number of officers on the street will not only allow us to enforce and stop the existing crime problems, but will also allow there to be some relationship building. And I'm absolutely committed to the Jacksonville Journey and the programs that work under the Jacksonville Journey. We have to be about prevention, intervention, and enforcement. So that is to say, look, kids need to know that that we're going to be there for them after school. We need to beef up out-of-school suspension programs so if kids are suspended, we're not just sending them, you know, back out on the street. They have somewhere to go where they can continue to be in a discipline and a learning environment. The other thing that I'm a big advocate for is ex-offender reentry programs. Look, they work. If someone has served their time and they want to integrate back into society, as a city, I will support and be right beside them, making sure that we have opportunities and programs for them so they can integrate back into society and be a successful member of the city of Jacksonville.
Thank you. Mary is on the line from the Town Center area. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Curry. I'm just calling to see how you plan on creating more job opportunities in Jacksonville.
Thank you, Mary.
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, on a number of the questions that I'm getting, I'm talking about parts of a plan that I have. Your listeners can find the whole plan at LennyCurryForMayor.com. Economic opportunity. I'm going to aggressively pursue economic opportunity for everybody in Jacksonville. And that's going to start with making Jacksonville a business-friendly city. Right now, it is not easy to start a business in Jacksonville. It is not easy to grow or expand a business. So the first thing that I'm going to do is a very detailed review of all permitting and all the business regulations in the city. And anything that is redundant, we're going to eliminate. And those that make sense, because you have to have a regulatory environment, you have to absolutely have a process in place. Those that make sense, I'm going to invigorate them with a sense and a culture of customer service. That is to say, when someone that wants to grow or expand the business comes in, they know that we want them there. We're there to be helpful. We're there to help them navigate the regulatory environment so they can take their idea and pursue their opportunity. The other thing that I'll set up is a one-stop quick permitting process. People that want to start a business or grow a business need to know that they can turn things around and make it happen quickly. Listen, I spoke, it was a month or so ago, I was speaking to an attorney that helps particularly minorities start small businesses. And he told me the story that happens every day in Jacksonville. Individual wanted to open a restaurant, got their space, got their permitting from the state, and it took almost 60 days to get permitting from the city of Jacksonville. People don't have 60 days of cash laying around, so it disincents people from starting small businesses. And I'm going to create an environment that gives everybody opportunity.
Going now to Facebook, we have a question from Stacy. She asks, Mr. Curry, if you had to find a place to cut fat in the city budget, would you consider cutting the cultural service grants? And are you a patron of the arts locally?
Yes, I think I believe in the arts. I'm absolutely committed to the arts. I'm not planning on cutting the arts. I was a member of the Symphony Board, have personally invested in the symphony over the years, and think that arts are critical to the future of Jacksonville. I tell you, one of the places we could start cutting is Mayor Alvin Brown's got the largest security detail and photographers in the history of Jacksonville. Hundreds of thousands of dollars go there, so I'm sure I could trim that right out of the gate.
If you're just joining us, we are talking to Jacksonville mayoral candidate Lenny Curry, and we have lots of calls still to come. James is on the line in downtown Jacksonville. James, you're on the air with Lenny Curry.
Hi, Mr. Curry. I just had a quick question about accomplishments. Bill Bishop has stated that he's most proud of a noise ordinance that he passed as councilman, and the mayor continues to tout a solid record with police and crime, but we know crime's going up and he's refused to meet with the sheriff. What would you say is your biggest accomplishment in the wake of such hollow accomplishments by the councilman and the mayor?
Thanks, James, for the question.
Yeah, thank you for your question. Well, let me say first, I'm incredibly proud of the fact that my wife Molly and I have built a business and a family here in Jacksonville. I'm blessed with a fantastic wife and kids, and just all of my dreams have come true and continue to come true in Jacksonville. Professionally, I practiced accounting with the largest accounting firm in the world here in Jacksonville for over 8 years. The experience that that gave me interacting with clients and with executives, the ability to negotiate, allowed me to then, over 10 years ago, take an idea and start my own small business. I was on a really good career path, but I felt a colleague and I felt like we had a fantastic idea, and we started our own business. That took courage. That took hard work. That took us not only have an idea, but writing a plan and pursuing and executing that plan every single day. And to be sure, the first few years were tough. To be sure, when we hit the recession, those were tough as well. But we continued to believe in our idea. We could see the vision ahead of us, and we continued to strategically work the plan with discipline and focus. And I'm incredibly proud that we've been successful, that we employ people, and that we're able to give back to the city of Jacksonville. And that is the exact same way that I will lead and govern our city.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. During the debate, a lot of questions focused on the downtown area, but Jacksonville is a lot bigger than downtown. So can you name a specific other part of town where you see a change that needs to be made?
Well, look, here's what I'm committed to in neighborhoods. Neighborhoods need to know that we're investing in them equitably and that it's not pitting one neighborhood against another. I met with some members of the CPAC last week, since Planning Advice Council, and I'm committed to continuing to meet with them and make sure that every neighborhood is represented, that where infrastructure needs are, that we're meeting those infrastructure needs, and it's not picking winners and losers, that it's equitable distribution of investment in infrastructure and services for every single neighborhood. And that starts with listening to the neighborhood organizations, meeting with them, understanding their needs. The other thing that I'll do is I will put up on the website, the city's website, a tracker that shows exactly when infrastructure projects in neighborhoods are to begin, what their progress is, and the expected completion date, so the people and citizens in the neighborhoods know exactly where we stand. Every neighborhood in Jacksonville matters. And look, I think it is just this wonderful asset we have that we're the largest geographic city in the United States. Because of that, we have so many different neighborhoods, diverse neighborhoods with diverse people. It's something that we really ought to celebrate. If you go from one part of Jacksonville to the next, you have a completely different experience. There are numerous experiences within our wonderful city.
And we have a caller calling from one of those areas of town, AJ in East Arlington. He's calling in. You're live on the air, AJ.
Hey, Mr. Curry. My question for you, how often have you been over to District 7, 8, and 9 since you've been running for mayor to talk to the people over in those areas? Those areas are some of the most neglected areas in our city, and I hear you talking about community building, but mostly I hear you talking about downtown. I hear you talking about every area of town, but how often have you been over in those areas to talk to the residents over there?
Thanks for your call,
yeah,
AJ.
That's a great question, AJ. Look, I've been knocking on doors on front porches all over this city over the course of this entire campaign. Most days I've knocked on doors and personally called people of Jacksonville, and including Arlington. And what I hear is this: people are disappointed that crime is up. People are disappointed that the value of their homes continue to decline. The home is the largest asset of most families, and here we are in what is supposed to be an economic recovery, and so many people, so many parts of Jacksonville continue to see the value of their home decline. By the way, and here's what I also hear on the front porches: while the value of their home continues to decline, their tax bill, the property tax bill, continues to go up, and that's because their taxes have gone up 14% since Alvin Brown was elected mayor.
All right, we have Ryan on the phone in Jacksonville. Ryan, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just was curious. I know you mentioned it briefly earlier, but I've run into issues expanding a business that I own here in town through permitting, and I was wondering what specifically you have in mind to approach the time it takes and the process, maybe streamline the process, make it easier for business owners in the community.
Yeah, thank you. Look, I have a very specific plan on this, and I have real experience with this, having started my own business in Jacksonville. There's a number of things I'm going to do, but one of the things I'll do is I'm going to move a high performer into the mayor's office. It will act as a small business liaison facilitator that will help every person that wants to start a business navigate the process. We will be an asset and an ally to people that want to start businesses, and I'm going to immediately review and audit all permitting and business regulation in the city of Jacksonville. And those that are redundant or don't work are just going to be eliminated. We've done this in the state of Florida and it works, so we need to do it in the city of Jacksonville as well. And I also will return to fast track one stop permitting. It's basically customer focused point of contact for all local and state permits. I'll tell you something else that I'm going to do that I think is critical. I'll work with a task force to review all state regulations and work with those folks in Tallahassee to eliminate those that are burdensome on, put too much of a burden on local businesses.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. Ricky on the north side, you are on the air with Lenny Curry.
Yes, Mr. Curry, it's a pleasure being able to speak to you this morning. And what I wanted to ask is your position on immigration. I know you have, from the Republican Party, so much, I think you must get a lot of pressure on it, but what is your position on it? I mean, there's a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of people that are here, you know, and need to have some kind of a clarity so they can, you know, move on with their life. So I'm wondering what your position is on that.
Thanks for the question, Ricky.
Yeah, thank you. Well, look, what's clear is the federal government has failed us on that issue. And look, I'll certainly advocate with our congressman and woman here in Jacksonville to make sure that we solve the issue. But let me say this about that issue. We have this issue because the United States is still the best country in the world. It is still a place that people want to come and pursue their hopes, their dreams, and their opportunities. So I think it would serve us all well if we step back for a minute and realize that people want to be here because we are the most opportunity and the greatest country on earth. I want Jacksonville to be the destination city, just like the United States is the destination country.
Well, thank you to all of our callers for your questions, and thank you so much, Lenny Curry, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, and I'm asking all of your listeners, I want to earn their vote. They can find out more about me at LennyCurryForMayor.com.
Okay, thank you so much, and much more still ahead on our program later in the hour, Blessings in a Backpack. But up next, the Jacksonville Sons of the American Revolution are dedicating a marker for the 1777 Battle of Thomas Creek. That's after this.
The Florida legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida public radio station.
That's Tuesday through Friday nights at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Congratulations to writer James English, winner of the first quarter of The Square. Now it's your chance to show off your art, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture, poetry, and more. Go to wjct.org/The Square, check out the amazing local talent, and submit your work now.
When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street.
Listen to After Hours to relax with music that spans the world in all styles from classical to doo-wop. Weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM.
A Revolutionary War marker will be dedicated in Jacksonville this Saturday. Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross. And here with more about that are David Ramsour, past state and local Sons of the American Revolution chapter president and the chairman of the Historical Marker Committee who worked to secure the land and establish this marker. Good morning. Good morning, David.
Morning.
Thanks for being here. And we're also joined by Dennis Carpenter, second vice president of the Jacksonville chapter of that organization. Welcome.
Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. So we're talking about a dedication ceremony happening this weekend?
Yes. It will be March 21st at 10 a.m., and it's really sponsored by the National Society Sons of the American Revolution and the Florida Society Sons of the American Revolution. And we'll be it's the 238th anniversary of this battle. And really, it's May 1777. Now, it's the southernmost battlefield of the American Revolution. And most people don't think that we have a battlefield in Jacksonville, Florida.
I didn't.
Most people think of Civil War, but we have a battlefield in Jacksonville, Florida, which I think Jacksonville can be very proud of. But the ceremony will be held at 10 a.m., and it's located 2145 Arnold Road, which is 2.5 miles west on Pecan Park Road that connects to Arnold Road there, which is exit 366 off I-95. So we're having people coming in from North Carolina, South Carolina, and they'll be in their color guard uniforms. So we'll be in the sort of like the movie The Patriot. We'll have the different colors and of the different uniforms with muskets and such as that. And also we'll have a representation by the SAR and the DAR and the Children of the American Revolution.
So you both study history. Can you tell us about this battle that we're commemorating here?
Well, the first thing about the battle is, I hate to say it, but we lost the battle. But the important thing is that we won the war. So that's always the important thing that we want to know about. But it was the second of three attempts, and actually George Washington had five attempts to more or less make Northeast Florida, which at this time was British territory. Prior in 1763, you had East and West Florida divided in two parts of the Apalachicola River. West Florida was from there. But East Florida was made up primarily of loyalists to the king and British citizens that were more or less stationed in St. Augustine in that area. So really, it was a real strong holding out for the British where they could supply the ships and the soldiers later for Yorktown and where else. But it was a large area of a British territory.
And what happened on that day in May?
We had approximately 109 militia men that were coming in to the battle. They were coming by horseback, and they were coming from Sunbury, which is several hundred miles north of us. And it was supposed to be reinforced by 400 other Continental troops coming in by the Amelia River and, by Nassau and St. Mary's and such as that. The problem that they ran into, they had several gunboats and they were loaded down with cannons, and the boats couldn't get through. So they were delayed, and that's what happened is that the 109 did not have support. And the British were able, with the Creek Indians and the Loyalists from this area, as well as the roughly 200 British soldiers, surprised them at the battle. And we fought somewhat, but yet we were seriously defeated by being attacked early in the morning there, not able to mount the horses and prepare easy defense and prepare their way.
So this happened 239 years ago,
well,
about?
Yes.
Why did it take so long to get this marker up here?
We did establish a marker in 1975 because in the last few years, in 2004, 2005, this area, this 846 acres with the city of Jacksonville dedicated as Seton Creek Historic Park last year. Last March, and we're doing this March here. Weather's a lot better in March than in May, and that's what happened to our soldiers at that time because of health conditions. And really, backing up a little bit, George Washington made 5 attempts to attack Northeast Florida to destroy the British stronghold there because they were supplying ammunition and everything else for the Revolutionary War. But we do have one marker that was dedicated by the Children of American Revolution off US 1, about 4 miles south of Callahan. So we found the artifacts from the battle area, which was more or less based on archaeological evidence that this battlefield did take place on this new Seton Creek Historic Park.
Dennis, can you tell us about what people should expect if they're coming to the ceremony this weekend?
Well, we're going to have a large group of participants from other states, from, like I say, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. We're expecting a mass color guard of about 26 or more persons presenting their colors, all in colonial uniforms. We're hoping to be able to do a musket salute, letting folks know that, honoring the sacrifice that these men made to try to secure the liberties for our country. We've got, like I say, all these people coming in presenting wreaths and, just local dignitaries. Last year when we dedicated the original park, we had the mayor's office was there. He came out and a number of the city dignitaries. And we're going to have some more people from the city there this year, as well as the Park Service. This is all part of the Timaquan Trail Historical Preserve. And so there'll be folks from Timaquan as well presenting.
And is it open to the public, the ceremony?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Please.
Okay, 10 o'clock on Saturday, right?
Correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you both for being here. That was David Ramsour and Dennis Carpenter with the Sons of the American Revolution. And later in the hour, we will get a preview of an upcoming golf tournament benefiting the nonprofit Blessings in a Backpack. But up next, we'll speak with the authors of a new book about the first African-American employees in the space program. That's right after this.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
I was 6 years old riding around in my parents' car, and I was like, what is this stuff? And I just kept listening.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again tomorrow to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
The space age was getting underway in this country at the same time the struggle for civil rights was brewing in America, forcing the government and the population to confront the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. A new book tells the story of 10 pioneer African-American employees in the space program and how NASA actually served as a bit of a launching pad for a more integrated America. Melissa Ross recently spoke with Richard Paul and Stephen Moss, the authors of We Could Not Fail, the first African-Americans in the space program.
Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us. It's always great to talk about this history, which has been lost up till now.
Yeah, this is not a story I think many know. What attracted you to telling this story?
Well, Stephen, why don't you begin with that, because it started with you, and then I found you about 10 years after that.
Well, I was in graduate school and looking for something to do a thesis on, and I was interested in the space program, and I started to notice small stories in the back pages of newspapers, and they all had to do with civil rights activity near where space centers were located in the South. And I thought, there's a story here. And then I had to prove there was a story there. And I wrote my thesis. And a few years later, Richard Paul discovers my thesis, and I'll let him take it from there.
That's right. I was at a conference that the National Air and Space Museum put together on the human impacts of the space program. What were the impacts on Earth, in art, in education, and all like that? And someone got up at this conference and delivered a paper talking about how we need to look at the space program in different ways. Don't look at it as a technology story. Don't look at it as a Cold War story. Don't look at it as a story of great men and their inventions. Try and find other ways to think about the space program. And he was giving all of these examples, and one of them he said, and I read this wonderful paper by someone named Stephen Moss about the impact that NASA had on civil rights. And I thought, wow, I'm a documentary producer. I thought, that sounds like a great topic for a documentary. And I got in touch with Stephen. I found his paper, got in touch with him, and we worked together on a documentary that I did. And then shortly after that, we put it together into a book.
Right. And it's fascinating because opening up federal employment due to the new equal opportunity laws that extended to NASA, and you write that you profiled 10 employees in particular, but in some cases they literally went from the cotton fields to the launching pad. Is that right?
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, it's sort of an amazing confluence of things that happened. President Kennedy, you know, regardless of what you think you know about John F. Kennedy's legacy and where his mind was on these things, he never talked during the campaign about space, going to the moon, and he never talked about civil rights. But in 1961, over the course of about 6 weeks, in April and May of 1961, all of these things came together. Yuri Gagarin becomes the first human in space. So now the Russians have put somebody in space, and the United States is behind in the Cold War. 8 days later, the Bay of Pigs disaster. American-backed rebels are wiped out, and there's now a Soviet ally 90 miles from Florida. May 5th, Alan Shepard becomes the first American in space. 9 days later, the Freedom Rides start, and that's where African-American and white young people got into a bus in Washington, D.C., and drove south with the blacks in the front and the whites in the back. And so they go down. On the 24th, 10 days later, the bus is firebombed in Anniston, Alabama. And the next day, President Kennedy commits America to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And a week later, mobs riot in Montgomery around the bus, and the governor declares martial law. So now the president is forced to deal with civil rights and space at the same time. And he knew he couldn't get a civil rights bill. Congress wouldn't debate it, let alone pass it. And so he turned to government employment as the way that he's going to integrate the American workforce. Stephen, talk about what he did on employment.
Well, actually, this is the anniversary of it. March 6, 1961, he signed Executive Order 10925 into being, and that would create the President's Commission on Equal Employment Opportunity. It would require federal agencies to review their own hiring practices with regards to racial discrimination. And it also required federal contractors, which would be thousands of jobs, period. But especially as NASA grew, it would be thousands of NASA-related jobs. But federal contractors could no longer, had to take, and these were important words for people of our generation, affirmative action regarding non-discrimination in employment.
And this forces the contractors and it forces the government to hire African-Americans for the first time. They can no longer discriminate.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And in particular, within the space program, that carried with it a lot of prestige, didn't it?
It would. And in Florida especially, the prestige mattered even more than the jobs did. Because the idea of the space age was often used by civil rights activists in Florida and in issues related to Florida to try to scold and shame the federal government into more action with regards to civil rights, particularly in the Cape Canaveral area.
That's right. There was a housing discrimination case that came up in the early 1960s. Stephen, what's that letter that the NAACP chair sent the president about that mentions the space program and all of the space imagery?
Well, there were actually two. One was from William Wells, which had to do with issues earlier on, and then Roy Wilkins from the NAACP wrote to President Kennedy about federal involvement in Cape Canaveral and discrimination there, and about thousands of African American who were employed at Cape Canaveral and at the Air Force Base who didn't qualify for federal housing because of its discriminatory practices. And so the NAACP, both locally and nationally, was getting involved using the space age and NASA's presence in Florida to try to force the government to live up to its promise to end discrimination.
Hmm. And tell me about some of the individual stories that you isolate in this book, a couple of the people you profile, their histories with NASA.
Sure. So, I mean, the best Florida one is the first gentleman that we talk about in the book, Julius Montgomery, and his story is amazing. He came to Cape Canaveral in the early 1950s, and, you know, Cape Canaveral, for people of my generation, I'm in my 50s, and everybody who remembers the space age, it was the place where the rockets left for the moon. But back then, it was a missile base, primarily, and Julius was hired. He was a range rat, and what they did was if a missile failed, if it blew up on the launch pad, or if there was a problem with it, the range rats would go out and they would diagnose the problem and then they would fix it. And he got this job to do this in the late 1950s, and at that time, the Ku Klux Klan controlled that part of Florida. The sheriff of Orange County was a Klansman. The city commissioners and aldermen and county commissioners in Orange County were in the Klan. There was one person who we interviewed who said local businessmen joined the Klan almost like joining the Rotary Club. And apparently the Titusville Advocate used to report Klan activities on the society page. That's how normalized the Ku Klux Klan was. And here comes Julius on his first day at work, and he walks into his workplace. There are all of these angry white men who are just furious, most of them probably in the Klan, angry white men just furious that someone had decided to hire a black man to work amongst them. And he walks up to each one of them, and he told me that they all turned their backs on him. Nobody would acknowledge him. Nobody would shake his hand.
Wow.
And he gets to the last guy. I love this story. He gets to the last guy, and the way he told me was, he said, I stuck out my hand. I said, hello, my name is Julius Montgomery. And he looks at me, and he says, boy, that's no way to talk to a white man. And Julius says, and I looked at him, and I thought, and I said, oh, excuse me, oh great white bastard, what should I call you? And he says, and he laughed, and I laughed, and he shook my hand.
And you've got many stories like that. This book is full of those kinds of stories, isn't it?
The bravery of these men, you cannot overemphasize how great it was. These were people who wanted to have a job in the space program so badly that they didn't care that they couldn't use the same toilet as their coworkers. I mean, their bravery is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What's the reaction been like since you've published this book?
The response has been so much that we could have hoped for, and even better than we could have hoped for. And it gets these stories and these men and their stories out there for the first time, and so it's really affirming that people are responding to these stories, and that their courage and in many cases their sacrifice and their risks are being acknowledged.
Absolutely.
And Richard and I are just excited about it.
Well, we're excited to speak to you. We thank you both so much for giving us your time, and kudos on the new book. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you so much.
And that was Melissa Ross speaking with Richard Paul and Stephen Moss, authors of We Could Not Fail, The First African Americans in the Space Program. That book will be in stores next month. I'm Jessica Palumbo. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Next Monday, a golf tournament will be held to benefit the nonprofit Blessings in a Backpack. Here to talk about that organization and the tournament is Michael O'Neill with Corner Lot. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
And Sarah Moores, a board member at Blessings in a Backpack. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And we're talking about this tournament. Can you tell us, Michael, where will this be held? What time?
It's at San Jose Country Club, over by the river near Bowles. It's next Monday at 8 a.m. That's when the registration starts and the shotgun starts at 9:30.
And this is still open for people to register for the tournament?
We're very close to being full, if not full already. That's what we were working on the last couple weeks to fill the last couple groups up. There's still spots for sponsorships available. Anybody can donate. We'd appreciate all of it. But as far as the tournament field, it should be pretty much full by now.
And Corner Lot is the sponsor of this tournament. And what is Corner Lot?
Corner Lot's a real estate investment company here in Jacksonville. We buy and flip houses. We buy and hold on to rentals as well. And Andy Allen, the CEO, and myself, we have a golf background, and he and I just wanted to give back to the community. And last year was our first event, first time putting on this event, and it was a lot of work, but it was well worth it. And this year we're really looking forward to having our second event.
And the proceeds of this tournament are benefiting Blessings in a Backpack. Sarah, what does Blessings in a Backpack do here in Jacksonville?
Blessings in a Backpack is a program that feeds children on the weekend. We have a lot of children in Duval County, St. John's County, that are going hungry on the weekend. In nationally, 21.6% in this country are at food risk for hunger. And that translates to about 16 million children in this country that don't know where their next meal is coming from. And that's where Blessings in a Backpack steps in and kind of fills that gap. During the week, they get fed through the federal free and reduced meal plans. But on the weekends, a lot of time they don't know where their food is coming from. So Blessings in a Backpack provides them food for the weekend. So we have companies like Corner Lot that comes in. It's a partnership between the private sector and the community that helps provide food on the weekend. So that's what we do. And locally for Duval and St. John's County right now, we are in 14 schools. We're feeding over 2,600 children, but we have a huge, huge number that are still going hungry.
Is there a waiting list for this program?
There is always a waiting list, and we have a lot of schools that are and parents that are contacting us and saying, can you help us? But we can't do it without funding.
How does it work exactly? I understand it's run by volunteers.
It is, and that's the beautiful thing about this program, because we are 100% done by volunteers. Every piece of money, everything that comes in goes directly to the programming. There are no overhead costs. There are no administrative costs. So 100% of the donations that come in go directly to our programming. So if you give us $100, $100 is going to feed a child. And that is the other part of this program that makes it so unique. We take $100 and that feeds a child for an entire school year, 38 weeks. Out of a year, a child can get fed for $100. That's it.
How does that happen? That seems like such a small amount of money.
It is a small amount of money. Basically, it's a weekend out with your husband or your boyfriend, and that's going to feed a child for a year. It's because of the partnership. It's because of the great relationships that we have in the community that we're able to do this.
And how physically does this program work? What exactly is a child taking home with them at the end of the school week?
It can vary. It depends on the menu, but because of our partnerships with the grocers that are providing the food, it's granola bars. It's actually food that the children can actually cook or prepare for themselves, because a lot of these children are going home and there aren't parents home on the weekend. So we want to make sure that whatever they can prepare for themselves. So it's easy to prepare. Sometimes it's simply granola bars and raisins and pop-top spaghettis or whatever it is that they can cook for themselves, because they don't have an adult around to help them out.
And thinking about hungry children right now, Duval County on spring break, does that make you think about those students even more right now?
Absolutely, because right now, because they are on spring break, means that they're not getting their backpacks. So they don't have food for this particular week while they're gone.
And what can people do if they want to help out with this organization besides the golf tournament coming up?
Well, we're so grateful for Corner Lots, because they are providing so much for us. They're supporting a school, and then they also have, they're able to help us out with some other schools where we were short on some funding. So it's amazing. But people can go to to blessingsinabackpack.org, and they can make a donation. Show it when you go in there to make your donation. Just designate it to Jacksonville, and it will get to us. But just donate. It can be a dollar. It can be $5. It can be $100. $100 will feed a child. So just go ahead and go online and make a donation.
Well, for the golf tournament coming up, that is Monday, March 23rd at San Jose Country Club. Limited registration spots still available. Registration starts at 8 a.m. Thank you so much, Michael O'Neill with Corner Lot. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you, Sarah Moores with Blessing in a Backpack. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is our program. Thank you to all of our guests and all of our callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme song, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast that's now up on iTunes. Next on the Diane Rehm Show, a Senate stalemate stands in the way of Loretta Lynch becoming Attorney General, extending an already lengthy wait. Diane looks at what's behind the stalled nomination of Loretta Lynch. That's next. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with Jacksonville mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.